Welcome to Libre Lounge, a podcast about free software, free culture, and all the other interesting aspects of user freedom, with Christopher Lemmer-Weber and Serge Roklowski.
Hi, I'm Serge. I use he, him pronouns.
Hi, I'm Chris. I use non-binary pronouns such as they, them.
And welcome to Libre Lounge, the COVID-19 pandemic edition, where we come to you more often with less editing and more off-the-cuff stuff. This time we have a guest with us, a repeat guest, our first repeat guest, Sean O'Brien, who many of you may remember from our Libre Planet 2019 episode, where he talked about privacy and specifically mobile issues and how mobile applications are spying on us all the time. Anyway, welcome back, Sean.
Hey, thank you for having me. Very excited. I use he, him pronouns.
So, Sean, well, we're excited to have you here for a number of reasons, but we wanted to have you on for something very specific, which is to talk about the EarnIt Act, or at least open with that. So this is a piece of legislation that is moderately important, I think, and maybe is on very few people's radar right now because the world seems to be otherwise on fire. So could you enlighten us as to what this is?
Sure. So to talk about EARN, I call it EARN-IT, but I guess EARN-IT is supposed to be clever. But to talk about that, we've got to start with Section 230. And some of your guests, you know, you have some, or listeners, I mean, have some technical background, so I'm sure they're aware of this, but just to give a quick overview, Section 230 is part of something called the Communications Decency Act. That came out in 1996. And it was sort of a surprise section when it came out. Communications Decency Act obviously is a regulatory act to sort of police the internet. It was a response to lawsuits, some pretty high-profile cases against CompuServe and Prodigy, for the people who remember those. Section 230 of this act was a real surprise, and this is why, you know, every bill needs to be watched. It's hard to tell what EARN-IT, you know, what the fallout's going to be or the impact or whether it just goes away. But anyway, there was a section in this bill that said, basically, if you're a provider of an interactive computer service, which would be pretty much anything we do, right, over the internet, then you're not liable for the content, right, for the speech of the users on your platform. So that little one-liner has basically driven a massive amount of growth in the internet. It's basically created the world we're in now. We have a sort of unique position in the United States having something like that in writing. And since it's been implemented, it's been fought tooth and nail by a lot of different groups. But basically, you know, it allows the YouTubes to exist, it allows the Facebooks to exist, and all that terrible social media that we don't like, right? That we're having so many problems with, or at least discussions about, let's call them, about moderation and infiltration, etc. But it's also allowed for, you know, a lot of the decentralized freedom-respecting services. It's allowed email providers, etc., not to have to do dragnet surveillance, although sometimes they do anyway, and so on and so forth, without having to feel like providing a service that is not actively policed all the time. You know, they don't have to do that kind of policing because they're not going to be held liable for the content that people say. Now, what the EARN-IT Act does, or intends to do, is say, okay, we're not going to get rid of Section 230, right? But we're going to create a set of standards, right? We're going to set its baseline principles that have to be followed. These best practices, which I think is the exact verbiage, if they're followed, then you get the intermediary liability. So that is problematic for a lot of reasons. The EFF has come out against this, the ACLU has come out against this, but on the flip side of the coin, there's been a lot of groups worried about sexual exploitation of children, child pornography, that sort of thing, that want this to go through. So, yeah, from my perspective, it's unconstitutional in at least two different ways. I know the EFF has listed much more complex stuff, probably five or six different things. But basically, the First Amendment, freedom of speech, it's problematic to do this kind of policing. It's problematic to give certain intermediaries, like let's say Google follows these best practices, right? They would get, you know, the free pass to not have liability. But if I set up an internet service or you set up an internet service and you didn't follow the best practices, or they determined for some reason that you failed in some way, then you wouldn't get the same freedom of speech, right? So that's already a problem for the Constitution. Yep.
So we've had in the past, just in the U.S. in the last couple of years, erosions of that already with Sesta Fosta, where it says, well, you're able to run your service unless some people complain about the way it's used as it relates to sexual things, and then your freedoms go away, essentially. So it's not like this comes out of nothing. It's like it's not a normal slow erosion, but we've already had that erosion, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would say so, and the same objections from a First Amendment standpoint definitely exist for Sesta and Fosta. I think Sesta and Fosta were positioned to try to strike down the Section 230 protections more broadly, and this is trying to shoehorn some regulatory framework into that environment. My feeling on this is that, you know, powerful players, the big tech companies, which I'm constantly railing against and very much worried about from a privacy perspective and also freedom of speech, but those big tech players rely on Section 230 to be able to do what they do, right? So they've pushed very hard and they've lobbied very hard to keep Section 230 going. And my feeling is that that's why we have this new bill. That's why Sesta and Fosta never really got the traction that I think a lot of those groups, child exploitation groups were hoping for. But it's very similar. You're correct to point that out. I would say in this bill, though, specifically, especially right now, from a Fourth Amendment standpoint, it's really scary to me because they're not mentioning encryption, but we have people in power who will be making the decisions about what those best practices are. And those people are very much vocal about putting back doors and encryption, et cetera. So that does change the conversation a little bit from a few years ago.
Yeah, and it makes me think about the Australian anti-encryption bill that passed in 2019, which radically changed the governmental powers in Australia so you could still have end-to-end encryption, but the government could mandate that back doors were put in so that, yes, you know, your and my conversation is end-to-end encrypted, but there's an invisible third party listening in. And according to my understanding of from the EFF on this, from a talk that they gave at Libra Planet in 2019, which is where we were, is that you weren't even allowed to talk about it, you weren't even allowed to disclose, etc. And it sounds like, you know, from what I'm hearing from you and others, that there are concerns that, as you say, the best practices might be those same kind of backdoors put into communication systems.
Yeah, so since the last time we sat down and talked, I became the editor of something called The Privacy Issue, which is a great site where we do a lot of articles on this sort of thing. And we've done a couple articles about Dragnet surveillance, talking about Five Eyes, which is US, Canada, Australia, UK, New Zealand, the information sharing alliance of intelligence agencies. And you correctly mentioned the Australian encryption bill or anti-encryption bill. There's also a lot of pressure in the UK to stop, to allow backdoors and to stop 5G implementation from overseas where the keys would not be in the control of the UK government. So there's some geopolitical sort of anti-China stuff going on here as well, conflicts between the powers. So I do recommend, if your audience is interested, checking all that stuff out. But what I will say very sort of quickly here is Australia seems to fall in line pretty quickly to some pretty totalitarian control of their information system. The UK is starting to look that way. And with this COVID-19 stuff and them having a bill passed that gives all kinds of emergency powers to Parliament, it's going to be very interesting to see what goes on there and probably very depressing. And then I do think here, EarnIT has the potential to be accelerated because of COVID-19 and the fact that people, A, aren't paying attention to it, and B, politicians are very likely to get more power and gain more power legally to do this sort of surveillance. But it was always very interesting to me that the U.S. would sort of propose and pressure allies, right, in this Five Eyes alliance to allow them to see communications, to make sure that they didn't go dark, so to speak. But here, it was always harder to pass it legally. Now, we know the NSA, et cetera, had CIA definitely as well, have found all kinds of tricky ways to get around that. But, you know, legal implementation, actual, you know, de jure implementation of an anti-encryption dragnet surveillance setup has not happened yet here. And the potential for EarnIT is for that to occur. Critics will point out that the word encryption is not used, but it doesn't really matter because the assumption is, and there's no other way to look at it, that if you need to police traffic, which is normally encrypted, you have to be able to read it. And if the providers are going to be held liable, they're going to need a copy of the private keys so that they can read the communication. There's just no way around it. It's just not possible. So I
think this is kind of interesting because we're hitting kind of a semi-golden age of, or like what looked like the dawn of the golden age, really, of end-to-end encryption in certain kinds of communication. And it looks like there's a good chance that that's going to be cut off fairly quickly if we aren't careful about it. Is that right?
Yeah, so what I would say is that, you know, when these laws are passed, it's not like everybody overnight just changes every practice they do. There's obviously a lot of what we would call grassroots software, right? A lot of the free software stuff that we know and love is not going to just roll over and stop doing what they're doing with, you know, double ratchet algorithms, etc. There is going to be some pushback from the big companies and so on. I would say, you know, I mean, it's like the net neutrality stuff. It's awful. You don't want to pass, but it doesn't necessarily mean that overnight everything is going to change. But, you know, having that stuff in law gives it the power to basically break down over time the protections that we've come to expect. And we were actually making a lot of traction and hopefully still are when this pandemic finishes. But, you know, I mean, most of the web is encrypted now, right? And it's encrypted in such a way that the providers may not know what you're doing, depending on the service and so on and so forth. And it's really awesome. And if we move away from that, I mean, we're in real trouble. So,
well, you just brought up a excellent aspect. Actually, it's come up a number of times in this episode, and no surprise since we're living in it. But, you know, I'd love to hear an expansion on why it seems like the pandemic may provide more of an opening for this. I mean, you'd think that, my feeling is, of course, during a pandemic, that's when politicians will all get together and be nicest and hold hands and help advance the world and so on. Is that not necessarily the outlook we're looking at here?
Yeah, so my reading of history is that moments like this are disastrous in some ways and open up avenues for freedom in others, but they take massive amounts of struggle to get those freedoms or maybe even expanded freedoms, right, pushed through. And then, of course, we've seen massive amounts of conflict, armed conflicts, etc., follow things like pandemics. Look, the entire destabilization of Europe in the, high medieval period, right? Crisis of the 14th century, so-called. there was consolidation of power, et cetera, et cetera. So although I won't say you can make complete, perfect historical analogies, yeah, I mean, things get a little scary, to put it mildly, when you have systems of power that are freaking out and are losing control in a lot of ways. My current reading of what's going on, both digitally and also more widely in society, is that all the trends that were being accelerated by technology, but were kind of not necessarily, you know, becoming true, are now going to become true very, very quickly. So, for example, everybody now has jumped into all of these streaming services. They've done it pretty much immediately and with no regard to privacy or security. It's just, you know, well, what can I use? I got to use this because I have to see if I can get my last paycheck from my boss, right? Et cetera, et cetera. So that's happening quickly. We're seeing the malls and the retail dying out. It's going to be pretty much completely gone. The push for media content into online streaming services, which was obviously already happening, that's going to be rapidly accelerated if there is such a thing as a movie theater left after this. We're going to see other industries that are near and dear to my heart, but maybe other people don't care about, like the comics industry, right? Moving completely online. They can't sustain in this environment, and basically their IP house is owned by big media companies now, so there's really no reason to sell physical books if they're going to lose money on them. We're going to see drones, right? We're going to see restrictions lifted on stuff like that. They're going to, oh, we need to do drone delivery. We need to do this, this, and this. There's been some experiments in New Haven with that already, unfortunately. I'm in New Haven, Connecticut, for the audience. You know, we might see more things like self-driving cars, which we know have major problems and so on. But I mean, if you've got a pandemic and you have a situation where you want to not have a driver, it seems to me that the logical conclusion would be to use a self-driving car, you know, to be damned about the safety and, you know, whether the thing crashes into whatever, you know, and that's sort of what goes on in these moments. You're correct to point out that our leaders, generally speaking, are going to be hungry for power. It depends. I'd like to think democratic states are a little less likely to turn into totalitarian ones immediately. But, I mean, we have a buildup of totalitarian structures, which EARN IT would accelerate. What we saw yesterday in Hungary, right, where the emergency powers were given to the prime minister there, you know, that's extremely problematic. And I do think vast parts of Europe and maybe especially Eastern Europe, it's tough to say, but perhaps the Mediterranean states like Italy, too, we're going to see some pretty rough stuff going on. So, yeah, the world's going to be very different if we do have a third appearance. And let's hope we do when the world exists in some form that we can have a talk like this. Without getting in trouble for it or arrested, you know, let's hope we can have that conversation, but it will be a very different world when that happens. So
obviously there's not much we can do about some of these threats, right? We can't individually do much about the end of Western civilization as we know it, but if we go by the basic assumption that Western democracy is still functional, what are some practical steps that people can take to potentially head off some of this and or protect themselves?
Yeah, I just want to say real quickly, and I did do a thread in Dr. O's Twitter for someone who was kind of depressed, saying all the positive things that I think could come out of this. So there are some things with movements and so on that can come out of it. So before I really get into that, I just want to say, look, we're going to see a lot of people who are looking at the world in a way that they have never looked at the world before. Things are much more malleable now than they were. We could have popular movements that really you know, move the needle in a positive direction for freedom, put more control back in the hands of labor. We could have situations where we have, you know, real social welfare here in this country, real universal health care, maybe something like a universal basic income, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and those kinds of things could be great. We could see new cultures come out of this. You know, everything moves into these streaming services, right? And it's the Disney Plus and it's Netflix and whatever. You know, you may see, and I know people don't like the whole quote-unquote piracy thing, but it's a way in which the information system can be a little relieved without people having to pay massive amounts of money each month just has a subscription to a service. And I do expect things like that to open up the information system. So anyway, as far as things to do, it's hard because, you know, in these moments, people are scrambling to just keep their head afloat and keep the money coming into the bank account. And then they're worried if the banks are still going to be there. But I would say that we have to have a measure of solidarity with each other. I think the issues we've seen with moderation and discussion on social media, especially that sort of have been coming to a head again during the election season, I think it'd be nice to see some of that sort of calm down and see people actually be able to have a more rational, or not necessarily even rational, but just a real conversation again. I think taking the lessons of the past and looking at the old internet, and maybe I'm just being a little nostalgic, but you know, looking at the way that forums and those ways of interacting and sharing information used to operate, looking at those and trying to bring some of that back, some of that culture back, might be very helpful. I think it could also be helpful in quarantine and mutual aid situations where, you know, people can help out other people, sharing information, sharing what supplies they have, sharing what skills they have to help other people out. So all of that can totally be done. As far as from... Yep.
Oh, sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. I just thought there's a good transition here. You know, you're bringing up lots of useful things that people can do in general, but especially people with the kind of backgrounds that much of the Libre Lounge community tends to have, which is tends to average more technically minded than the average audience. Like, are there ways in which, you know, the kind of Libre Lounge type listener, or, you know, free software people in general, might think about to be able to help and better the world in this moment?
Sure. So as far as response to the pandemic and response to the shortages on supplies, I think the initiatives being done by Makerspaces and Hackspaces have been awesome. The local Makerspace here in New Haven, Makehaven, they've done quite a bit of work doing masks and 3D printing what parts they can 3D print for hospitals. And that helps with the shortages, which will continue and I assume are going to get worse before they get better. There's an initiative out right now called Hackers in Hospitals that the FSF is helping to promote. And that initiative is sort of trying to bring together a lot of disparate, currently disparate efforts around, you know, sort of trying to help with the supply chain issues with medical supplies and masks and so on. So that's great. But I also think, you know, where and when we can sort of embrace quote-unquote alternative technologies, you know, setting up a Matrix channel, you know, and trying to get your friends and family into it. So you now have a real place that you can communicate that's not under total surveillance, that is your, you know, chat room, right? And now you can start sharing information, even just having that more interpersonal conversation that, what are you going to do it? And you're going to do it in a Facebook group, maybe, you know? We can start doing that stuff. And I would say that the technically adept folks, or people who are just willing to read documentation, right? You know, a lot of this stuff is pretty easy to set up. We should be doing those kinds of things too. You know, I'm a very sort of let's decentralize the cloud, get rid of the, you know, extreme reliance on these centralized services person. I do understand that, you know, I mean, times are tough and people are going to jump into whatever they need to jump into to have a conversation or get stuff done that they need to get done, right? Get work done and so on. But, you know, I mean, as time goes on and we're spending more and more time indoors, I do think some experimentation and some attempts to break out of just ending up in two or three de facto video conferencing environments is also going to be pretty helpful.
So let's jump into the elephant in the room here, which is Zoom. And I immediately thought of you when it came out that the Zoom iOS app was using the Facebook SDK, which meant that everybody using the iOS app was having their data sent to Facebook. And then just yesterday, as of the date we're recording this, two zero-day exploits were released about Zoom. And in addition, I think it was yesterday or the day before, it was shown that although Zoom claims that it has end-to-end encryption, it doesn't actually have end-to-end encryption.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it's becoming the de facto collaboration, you know, large collaboration tool. If you have more than 10 people, everyone's using Zoom. So, and in fact, that's what inspired me to contact you about and come on the show was both Earnit and especially Zoom. So I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Sure. So to start, Zoom is proprietary software, right? Not to bring everything back to free software all the time, but the important thing to note here is that free software isn't a guarantee of perfect security, of course, or, you know, good security at all necessarily. But what it is sort of a baseline requirement. So the security problems that Zoom has, and it looks to be a very cobbled together app. I was just looking at the installer and looking at my local install of it here because I've been having to use it to talk to people. You know, it seems to have a number of problems. So not just the way it works, the way in which it installs, and it seems to bypass on other operating systems, not GNU Linux, but Mac OS X and Windows, it seems to bypass all kinds of administrative controls that are supposed to be security controls on those OSs, right? But it also has potential licensing issues, right? It uses 7-zip. It seems to be using a lot of other copyleft code. I know a lot about license violations, but I don't want to make a judgment yet. But I do see a lot of Qt stuff in there that is questionable. Stuff that's under the GPL 2 and 3 that could be problematic. So all that stuff is true, right? But this is what happens with proprietary software, right? There's no eyeballs on it. The internal practices could be spaghetti code, just cobbling stuff together for all you know. There's going to be huge issues with the code, and there's no accountability, generally speaking. And this is the problem that organizations, when they do decide, right, to take some proprietary app and to actually, quote-unquote, open up the code, that this is the challenge that they have. They might have decades. I mean, Zoom doesn't quite have decades, but it may even have a full decade now. I can't remember when the company started, of crap in there. And so a lot of that's going to lead to security issues. And now that they're under scrutiny, because they had huge amount of growth because of COVID-19, now that they're under scrutiny, security professionals are going to point all that stuff out. They have an opportunity to turn the page. They have an opportunity to gain trust and so on. But as you correctly point out, they seem to have a motivation to be collecting private information and more private information than they're telling their users and sharing it with third parties like Facebook. So all that stuff is pretty awful. It's not unexpected. The whole thing with end-to-end encryption, I had talked to Yael Grauer, who's a great reporter who worked on that with Michael Lee. I looked at the security paper that Zoom put out, and I was like, yeah, no, this is more like a TLS handshake that it's doing. It's not doing, you know, double ratchet or any of that stuff we would call end-to-end encryption. A lot of apps in the past have used marketing terms like that. I will say it's completely incorrect for them to have done it. I think a lot of institutions chose Zoom because of the, let's face it, lie that it's end-to-end encrypted. How the heck are they going to end-to-end encrypt it if they're also going to surveil their users, right? So this goes back to the Earnit stuff. If we were to pressure Zoom to implement good quality, you know, E2EE in the app, the monetary value of surveilling your users goes out the window. And that's the thing that the investors care about. That's the thing the company cares about and so on. So we really just have to get away from this stuff. And, I do have to say, elephant in the room for myself, you know, I've been using this stuff. I've had to use Google Hangouts also, which I haven't even touched in, you know, I don't know, a year or 2 years recently to talk to people. I use Google Hangouts. I may end up having to use Microsoft Teams at some point. These things are becoming as ubiquitous as the telephone, and I actually think there's going to be a lot of people questioning whether they need a cell phone plan for what they do, especially if they live in a city, and so on. You know, these things may become the real de facto, you know, Zoom may be more popular than a phone in a couple months, if it's not already being used more, if these types of platforms are not already being used more than, you know, traditional phone infrastructure at this current moment. I don't know. I don't even know how you would study that. So for my own part, you know, I don't want to say, you've got to make a judgment call for yourself about the value that you get out of talking to someone over Zoom, but you should have no illusions that it's giving you any measure of security or privacy. And if you can, you want to try to sandbox that as much as possible. I'm very much thinking about having basically a burner laptop with an operating system I don't trust on it, just to use these kinds of tools, because I don't want to have my other communications potentially violated because I have something like Zoom installed. And I will say I'm guilty as well. We are putting together a online summit called Flatten the Curve Summit. We've got some great speakers, including folks from Free Software. We're going to be demoing some stuff for GNU Health. We've got some physicians and public health experts. We've got Cory Doctorow. We've got Gabriella Coleman. We've got the Hackers for Hospitals folks. And we're going to talk about some awesome, awesome free software stuff, but we are going to be using Zoom. We've got a 2-person team right now, maybe a 3-person operating the video feed. And what are we going to do when we need 100 users in a room? It's the only thing out there that checks the boxes we need. So kind of sucks.
Yeah, that, to put it mildly. That is a challenge when you know all the problems of the thing you don't want to use, but don't have something lined up to be able to be like, oh, okay, let's do this instead. I mean, it just seems to be a pretty common problem. But I mean, I think that doesn't make it not worthwhile, even when you know you can't make it to the place you want to get, to not be aware of the problems that are available, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we're very lucky, especially post-Snowden, that we had such a diverse and dedicated effort put into strong encryption, both at a low level, right, but also, you know, good user interfaces, great communication apps and so on that people can actually, you know, use. So, you know, we do have a rich variety of stuff out there now, but before we had that stuff, it doesn't mean that you don't criticize the, you know, the crappy situation that you're in. And I think that's something we need to also keep in mind. I have seen some, you know, InfoSec Twitter, as I call it, individuals sort of be like, oh, well, it's no big deal because of the threat model and, you know, let's not freak out about this. But the criticisms are legitimate. We should talk about them. We should see if, especially if on a long-term curve, we can start replacing this stuff, just like, you know, all the other great free software projects, especially from the beginning with GNU, right? You replace the pieces you can and you keep moving and you hope you can do the work. I do also think that threat modeling and traditional sort of cybersecurity models don't take into account personal autonomy and long-term what I would call ecosystem effects. So, you know, just because, you know, in this very short-term mindset, the proximal problem, right, you may not have a situation where you have somebody spying on you or you don't care about the words that are coming out of your mouth, whether they were spied on, doesn't mean that you don't have a long-term problem coming down the line. As we see governments change and shift and, you know, like we were talking about, it's very likely to become less democratic. Who the heck knows if the things we now take for granted as being okay to say in a certain context are going to come back to bite us? And they totally could. So,
look, it's important that we don't get overwhelmed by this, you know, because if we do, then we're frozen in fear. But it's scary, and it's healthy for us to have these conversations where we directly confront these issues head on. And I'm glad that we're having you on, and I'm glad that you can talk so coherently about these, you know, topics that frankly for me are somewhat overwhelming. So I mean that sincerely, that we're glad you're here. You know, are there things that we haven't brought up that you think are really important that are maybe not getting the attention they should be getting?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that we need to take a close look, and just to keep sort of the tech angle, but still talk about the bigger issues. The changes that we're going to see are going to remove some industries from the picture completely and just alter others in ways that are problematic. Like I said, potentially accelerating and very likely accelerating some trends that have already been going on. One of the things that has been going on is untrustworthy, unprivacy respecting, that's a terrible word, but you know what I mean, surveillance technology in retail and in personal spaces, facial recognition technology, these kinds of things, which, you know, just a week before COVID really hit in my city, you know, I was looking at introducing a piece of legislation that would have banned, you know, would have made us one of the cities banning facial recognition. And if we take our eye off of that, or if we allow, for example, some of the types of surveillance that are coming through to quote unquote control the epidemic, if we allow that stuff to come in, it's going to be problematic because, you know, it's like tarmac, right? You lay down a parking lot, it never comes up again. You know, and even if you did, it's not like you're going to go back and replace a wetland or, you know, replace whatever, a meadow. You end up in a situation where this stuff is implemented and it just becomes part of the world we're in. So I do think we need to think about that. We need to think both about the private retail, you know, the Bluetooth low energy devices that are doing geofencing, tracking people around grocery stores and so on. The automation of the retail experience, which will be increased by this, but was already starting to happen. So Walmart's already had pickup boxes that you would order ahead of time and go and grab this stuff, but also self-checkout, right? There's some scary stuff happening. Companies like Amazon are putting in Whole Foods, which they own, you know, scanners for people's hands that would actually try to come up with a unique pattern for the veins under your skin, basically, to identify you. And whether or not that works, you know, I don't know. Maybe that technology is a joke and it doesn't work. But the point is, those kinds of things are going to be thought about much more strongly now. And in some ways, you know, it may be, you know, correct, right? You want to have social distancing. You want to have situations where people are touching things less and are more sanitary and practicing better hygiene by default, right? But in other ways, there's going to be surveillance baked in. So we need to sort of keep our eyes on that stuff, too, as it starts to come down. And then, you know, lastly, I would say as a response to that, we could be implementing IoT devices that are not that, right? That are doing some of the work and are solving some of the practical problems, right? But are not violating people's privacy. So there's a lot of different ways that you can count that a person is in a room, you know, and I've done some of this work myself before for civic organizations where we're just basically counting people, right? We don't have to track them, geofence them, come up with demographic profiles. We just want to do the equivalent of clicking a clicker in a room, right? And you can do that sort of stuff. And I think hackers and technically minded folks can think about all kinds of ways that that kind of stuff can be done in a privacy respecting manner. And hopefully we can sort of keep back the tide of some of this other stuff.
All right. It sounds like, you know, we have a lot. Look, we'll link to some resources for learning more about some of the practical things that we can, you know, we can do about like EarnIt. But I also remembered you said earlier that you were doing a privacy conference. Do you want to plug that before we wrap up?
Yeah, absolutely. So some of the listeners may know. I started a small company called Privacy Safe back in September. We did a crowdfunder, which didn't turn out so well, moved to a direct order model. But basically, we take free software, put it on open hardware, Beagle boards, and we do some interesting things with it. And the interesting thing we are doing right now, we've had it, you know, on the development schedule, and we're working on it, but we really moved it from the back burner to the front one because of COVID-19 here, is a GNU Health appliance. And GNU Health is a hospital information system. It does a broad amount of things, keeps all kinds of information that other more traditional hospital information systems might not. But it also can be implemented on small pocket-sized devices, be used for personal health tracking, quarantine environments, rural clinics and hospitals that don't have tons of cash to drop on these enormous systems and are being stressed right now, right? And so on. So, you know, I and a team, a couple other people who are working on this, we said, well, you know, let's try to put together an online summit. Let's bring together awesome speakers who can talk about this. We'll have Luis Falcone from GNU Health talk. We'll have some physicians. So we've got Trish Greenhout from University of Oxford, very well-known physician. We've got some speakers about law and cyber conflict and some of these other issues, some of these other crises that we're facing. And let's have them do a remote summit. Set it up to be pay what you can. So you pay $1 if you want, or you pay, you know, our suggested is $25, and we would very much appreciate it. But, you know, everybody's cash strapped right now, and we really just want to make sure attendees get a lot out of the experience. So we're calling that summit Flatten the Curve. Flatten the Curve being the phrase that listeners may have seen on social media about, and also on television, about trying to get rid of this exponential growth curve of both people with the virus and people dying from the virus, right, in our society, and flattening that out and making it reasonable and, you know, at least somewhat, you know, actionable and able for our healthcare systems to handle. So we flatten that out. We extend the time period. We limit the amount of patients that are having to fill beds in hospitals by staying home and quarantining and all the things that we're doing right now. So Flatten the Curve Summit, which is flattenthecurve.tech, is the name of this event. We put together in a little over a week, but we've got some great speakers. I think it's about 20 right now, and we're adding a few to the schedule. It's 3 days. It's all going to be remote. We are going to use Zoom and use it for recording, but we will be putting the videos up on both YouTube and a PeerTube instance afterwards. I don't know what the schedule is going to be for that. But if you attend the conference, you can do a Q&A and so on. You can see the demos live. You can potentially sponsor one of these privacy-safe health edition devices with GNU Health on it for a hospital or rural clinic implementation. You know, we're looking right now on where we can deploy them, Argentina, some other places. And if folks want to, you know, try to sponsor that work, we will make sure it gets done. So, yeah, very cool stuff. I'm trying to turn lemons into lemonade, keep moving. I'm a bit of a workaholic anyway. So, you know, when times are tough, this is what I do. But, you know, so many people are also doing that. So I think that's a good attitude if we can embrace it, at least for a while. Keep moving, keep trying to look at the more interesting, more malleable things we can do with the tools around us.
Yeah, so. I agree with you, Sean, that I think right now, you know, a lot of us are stuck indoors, which means that we're getting more done, we're more productive. But as you say, you know, well, as you've said here, we need to both be aware of the greater repercussions of this global pandemic and also stay in the moment and keep working on the things we can. So I think this is a good place for us to wrap up. We've covered an enormous amount every time we talk to you, all two times, so that therefore there must be a trend. You know, it's been a really interesting and dense conversation where I know I'll be re-listening to this episode a bunch of times and thinking about everything we've discussed. So with that, if you would like to join us, us being mostly Chris and I, but also some occasional guests, we're on IRC, we're at Hash Libre Lounge on Freenode. Join us on the Fediverse at LibreLounge at floss.social, email us podcast@LibreLounge.org, or you can find us on Twitter at Libre Lounge. And with that, Chris, Since we're about to say, you haven't said anything for a while, so I want to make sure you're still here.
I'm still here. I'm just listening. There's been so much. Yeah, no, I really enjoyed this episode as well.
So, and thank you, Sean. Thank you for being here and joining us through this difficult time and scaring the crap out of our audience and ourselves and giving us some things to think about and do.
Awesome. Be well, guys, and thank you.
Thank you. All right, take care. Bye.
You've been listening to Libre Lounge. You can find and subscribe to us at LibreLounge.org. This podcast is released under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 4.0 International License. Our theme music is Bossa Nova by Joth, which is waived into the public domain under CC0 and which you can find on OpenGameArt.org. If you'd like to support Chris Weber's work on this and other user freedom projects, you can donate at patreon.com/CWEBBER. Thanks for listening. See you next time.